you can have a brand that sells 5,000 skis a year and be profitable doing it this way. Before, I would have had to sell 30,000 plus pair. That's what I learned, is that K2, you can never get profitable selling to a retailer until you get up to that huge volume. And as a startup, you will never hit that volume. You can't.
Welcome to Learning Life.
And the thing that I've realized, from the CEO to the NFL football player to the janitor, we're our toughest critics and we're hardest on ourselves.
But you have to be willing to say and point out the things that need to be said.
The only way to grab somebody's attention is with a story.
Welcome to Learning Life with John Toda and another Vermont Local episode. My guest today is one of the icons in the ski industry over the past two decades. Jason Leventhal founded Line in his parents' garage back in 1995 and is known for creating some of the first twin-tip skis back in the 90s and helping to grow freestyle skiing into the mainstream sport it is today. Jay sold Line skis to K2 Sports in 2006, and the brand went on to become the fifth most popular U.S. ski brand in 2013 under his leadership there. He also brought back a legendary ski boot design as Full Tilt Boots and helped lead that to become a top 10 U.S. ski boot brand as well. In 2013, Jay set out to disrupt the ski industry again when he founded Jay Skis in Burlington. But this time he's innovating with the business model and not just with his products. Jay Skis has a unique direct-to-consumer approach that incorporates consumer feedback, limited edition runs, and a community approach that's unlike anything in the industry today. It's an honor to have Jay on the show with us today to share all that he's learned while pioneering an industry. Jay Leventhal, welcome to Learning Life.
Thanks. That was an amazing intro, man. I got to write that down and put it on my website.
Yeah. I'll give you the copy. There's a ton of all the articles and interviews you've done, so it's easy to do research on you, man. So right thank on. You for making the time. Yeah. So I always start with everyone, because we're talking about Vermont local entrepreneurs, about their journey, what brought them to Vermont. And I know you grew up in Albany. So tell us a little bit about the journey, what brought you here in the first place.
Well, growing up in Albany, we always aspired to go skiing north and in Vermont. Vermont, you know, was just the epitome of skiing in the east. And so we would, once I got my driver's license, me and my friends would always make it up to Stratton or Killington or Okemo and whatnot. And a lot of times Stratton, we'd always stop by the Burton factory. So that was always inspiring. You know, when snowboarding came to be, I got into snowboarding and we'd stop there and just really inspired by what Jake was doing with snowboarding in the early days, and which definitely inspired me to start making skis much further down the road. But just Vermont in general was just the epitome of where you want to go skiing.
Yeah, yeah. And I know, you know, I watched your TED Talk, which I highly recommend. It was a great listen. And you talk a little bit about those early years when I think you're at University of Buffalo and your senior project, right, was designing those kind of very first short twin tip skis. Tell us a little bit about that, because that was kind of the genesis of everything that you went on to do with Line, right?
Yeah, I wasn't big into doing a lot of reading and schoolwork. So this program was a design graphic and product design program. And it enabled me to just go to a wood shop and make things when I wanted to. And it was like a senior project that we could make whatever we wanted, any type of product. And I had always, I mean, many, many, many years, always just wondered why skis weren't designed like a snowboard, why they weren't twin tip and symmetric and wider. And, you know, I could do so much more on my snowboard than I could on my skis. And I just wanted to apply those attributes that made a snowboard what it was to skis. And that's just what I did. I was big into inline skating at the time too. So it was just that versatility, maneuverability you could get with inline skates that skiing really didn't have. Skiing was based on racing at the time. Yet every other sport around there, you know, like whether it was rollerblading or skateboarding or wakeboarding, BMX biking, I was into all those things. They were all evolving pretty dramatically from the traditional versions that they used to be, you know, like cycling became, you know, BMX, where all of a sudden you're going from riding a bike on a road to now riding a bike in a half pipe. You know, it's all because the product design evolved. And so that's what I was inspired by to do with skis. And I made a pair of short twin tip skis as a senior project, and then went home and started trying to mass produce them in my parents' garage, and eventually started Line Skis, that ski brand.
And I know some of the story where you kind of got that first big order for, I think it was like 1,000 skis.
Yeah, from a Japanese distributor, yep.
And then now you're breaking into an industry. You're right out of college building skis in your garage. And I think from some of the stuff I saw, big ski companies are doing 100,000 or more skis a year.
Oh, yeah, hundreds of thousands, sure.
How do you compete with the brands that are out there? I think the big one at the time was like a Salomon who was trying to do the same thing. What sets you apart? How are you able to compete and even make a name for yourself in an industry that's probably not that friendly to disruption?
It's like anything, you just about being persistent, not giving up. I think a lot of that came from skiing itself. You know, like you don't learn a 360 or any trick your first try or even your third try. Sometimes it takes a full day of trying and multiple days and you're falling down and sometimes you get hurt or whatever, or it seems like you're not going to make it. But if you try again, there is a chance. And it's just like having that fire to think, I think I could do it this time. And just, it's all trial and error, everything in life, really. You know, like you learn some stuff, but honestly, a lot of the stuff you learn in school doesn't really apply to real life, you know? And so you just end up going and going, and no matter how beat down you get, you don't really care and just keep making a go at it. Even when you're making no money, even when you're losing money, even when people are saying you're going to go out of business or whatever it is, you know, I just had that fire in me to make it happen. And not to say I really financially succeeded, you know, in a short period. It took a long time to figure it out. There was a lot of different evolutions, I guess I'd say, of the business.
Yeah, and I know you've talked about this at different points in different interviews that I've heard, but that idea of following your passion, and like you said, it can't be about the money, because mm-hmm. when you're trying to break into an industry as an independent brand and yeah. disrupt it, the money's not going to come easily. And that's not why you become an entrepreneur. You do it because you want to see the change and you care so much about the industry. Was that the motivating factor? Is that what kept you going, even though you kind of kept hitting these obstacles to try and get over and through?
Yeah. It's just a vision. Just trying to see your vision through. Simple as that.
Yeah. And so I think it's great because you look at the little skis that you made back then, and then you look at the skis you're designing today, and they just look like bigger versions of those little guys at this point, right? It's just...
Right.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of people, you know, they laugh at what we were doing back then. And I do too. You know, I mean, you can laugh at it. It's all good. But like the reality is, if you look at a ski at the time in 1995 and you look at the ski board or ski blade or whatever you want to call it, because people couldn't even accept it as a ski simply because it was shorter and twin tip, they had to call it something different. And then you look at what we're riding on today, it's a lot closer to what we had then. And so at first, when you make something that's dramatically different, on your own, you don't have the power to convince the world that like this is where it's going or this is the new norm. It either takes forever on your own or you have competition that come in, and having competition was the best thing that could have happened to me. Like eventually Salomon and some other brands started making similar products, and that's where it took off. I couldn't have made it without those other brands selling the same product, to be honest with you. Like I just never had the reach, especially in the late 90s. You didn't have, you know, social media and YouTube and every other now affordable way to get the word out just didn't exist. I couldn't afford the type of ads I would need to spread the word.
Yeah. And I think that's such an interesting perspective too, is that everyone's always concerned about the competition, but like you're saying, until you have competition from those big brands, you don't have the credibility that you need in the market. And so it's tough, but it also kind of gives you that boost to the next level, where today I would say like my kids, they wouldn't ride any skis that weren't twin tips, right? Like that's all these kids want now. And I know, and I think one of the cool aspects of your story is that I think you took a bronze medal in the X Games slope style, right? So like, did that was, and I know one of the riders on one of your line riders took gold in that same X Games. Was that such a big piece of you guys coming on the scene and line really kind of showing up because you were athlete owned and you had that credibility?
Yeah, it was pretty rare. I mean, you got to remember though, every ski brand was started by a skier at some point. You just forgot the face that went with the name, you know, but in recent decades, there hasn't really been a new ski company and certainly not like a face behind the brand. Salomon they leveraged their sponsorship of the X Games to get this sport in there. It was the first time skiing was in the X Games in any capacity. So we were in the snowboard slope style basically, but with these skis on our feet and short twin tip skis. And I got bronze. My friend Mike Nick got gold, who was actually in the area too, still in Burlington. And yeah, it put us on the map because it was like national stage. And from that day on, everyone understood what this was, what the potential was, or they started to get it. And, you know, like we had, there was articles in the New York Times and Newsweek and like, you know, the next big thing and like is ski boarding the next snowboarding, you know, because snowboarding was taking over skiing at the time. And this was like the ski industry's last hope of trying to revitalize skiing, like a ski on each foot. Like at the end of the day, does it really matter? You're sliding down the snow, you know, you're having fun. Who cares what you're on? But the traditional ski companies, especially the Euro-based companies, were pretty scared of what was going on with every young person jumping on snowboards instead of skiing. So this really reinvigorated energy around what skiing could become and be and the product designs. And for the next 10, 15 years, the product evolved really fast.
Yeah. And I think just seeing where skiing went from, you know, I think we all had, you know, 195, 200 long skinny skis, right? And then, and what they are today, it's just amazing to see. And it, now going all the way back, when did you make the transition? Obviously you had to keep expanding to be able to produce more skis. And then, you know, ultimately you sold to K2 Sports. When did you get to Burlington? When did you move the operation?
That was in 1999 or around like 2000-ish. I mean, really what happened is from 95 to 2000, I basically gained a ton of credibility and awareness in the industry, but we were like financially going out of business because we were selling to retailers. There's very little margin, very low volume at the end of the day compared to these bigger brands. And so we never had the profit we needed to do all the things required, ads, athletes, events, you know, the whole, everything we were doing was the same thing Rossignol was doing, another big ski company, but we were tiny and we had no margin. So we basically financially were just on the verge of bankruptcy. And Carhu was making cross-country skis, hundreds of thousands of cross-country skis, about close to 100,000 snowboards for Burton up in their factory in Canada, but they were based in Burlington. And they saw this as the next big thing to get into Alpine, you know, the next growth segment. So they acquired Line, and then we were with them for until from 2000 to 2006 and took it as far as we could. We got up to about maybe 7,000-8,000 pair of skis. They were longer skis by then, but it was still so hard. Like you said at the beginning, like how are you competing with these big guys? You really can't. You know, 8,000 skis compared to Salomon's making 300,000 skis, they control the stores. I mean, the stores were controlling or AKA limiting our ability to distribute our product. So, you know, you go into a store and there's 5-10 slots on the wall for skis. How many do you think you can get? Maybe two, you know, and how deep are those going to go, that inventory? So like they're going to buy from Rossi, Salomon, K2, all the big brands first, because they're going to get the best money, you know, for it. They're going to make the most money on them. They've got the most marketing, so it's going to be the easiest to sell. And then they'll cherry pick a couple of our skis, but we're limited. So in 2006, we kind of hit a brick wall again, and we're like, geez, we can only take this so far, you know, on our own. And we sold it to K2, which again, acquired it just for the assets, just for the, you know, we were basically on the verge of bankruptcy again. We were in debt, huge debt. Even more than the first time. And K2 paid off our debt and acquired us. And then I went on to work for them. The moral of the story is, one, don't give up. And two, like you may not make money selling a company, you know, but the company can live on and you can gain in a number of ways if you stay with it, possibly. And that's what I did.
Yeah. And so that's another interesting part of the story, because you went, and I think of you as a true serial entrepreneur in the ski industry, but then you have this stint where you took a high level executive position running the brand at a big company. And I think even K2 was owned by a larger company.
Oh yeah, they're a gigantic public company. Yeah.
So what was that like for you operating inside of such a large company where I guess you probably represented a small piece of this very big pie? How did it feel? Did that hold you back at all? Or did you love the opportunity to be one of the big players who could really get shelf space like the other guys?
Yeah, it was nuts because I didn't want to move out to Seattle. I went out there and I just thought we were having a kid at the time, me and my wife, and we were just like, this ain't worth it. I ended up telling K2, like, here's the deal. Like, if absolutely the only way I can work for you is to move out here, then we got to call it a day. But I think I could work from home for you and do a great job. And if I don't, let's just part ways then. At least we give it a go. And the only reason I was passionate about giving it a go. My uncle had told me, he goes, you know, you have an opportunity to learn a lot working for this type of company. You've never done it. You've never been at like at this capacity at this, you know, a public company. He's like, the worst case, you don't like it after 2 years, call it a day, you know, quit. But in those 2 years, you might gain so much experience that you otherwise would never be able to get in your life. And I actually followed through on that. And I'm glad I did, because I was definitely coming from like, oh, screw those guys, big public company, we're going to get watered down. And instead, I just said, I'm going to see where this takes me. And I learned a ton working for this. I mean, I'm sitting at boardroom meetings, you know, with like 20 people in the room. I didn't even have 20 employees ever, you know. So like, there was crazy decision making and global strategy and all this stuff that I was picking up. And they saw huge value in me because they didn't have that understanding that I did of like hands-on entrepreneurial perspective. And so I would use their resources. For example, they said, hey, why don't you make poles? I was like, oh yeah, we can make poles. If you can build them, sure, we could sell poles. And like, boom, like we came up with creative designs and marketing, and they made them without me having to do anything. You know, I came up with all the designs and the, you know, aesthetically and engineering wise and marketing wise, and they create the product, they have distribution globally, and boom, it's like plug and play. So that was a big benefit in my life of gaining perspective I otherwise never would have had.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of neat too, to see it from both sides. You've kind of led the fight against all those big brands. Then you were, then you were in there, you know, leading one of them, you know, and then, you know, this kind of brings you to the next chapter of your career, which I think is super cool, because now you've seen it from both sides. You've been the little upstart, you've been the big dog who has all the retail exposure. And then when you started J Skis, your plan, I think, now is knowing what you know and taking all those lessons you learned at K2 Sports, now you're kind of changing the model a little bit and doing it differently. What's the driving force? Tell our audience a little bit about what the kind of the mission of J Skis is.
That was a lot of years. If you go from 95 to, with K2, I was there from 2006 to 2013. So from 95 to 2013, that was a lot of years of doing things one way, but just simply in different size operations. And I learned really everything I loved about being in the industry and everything I hated. And I also gained perspective of like things that I just felt eventually became a broken system due to modern technology and ways to market and distribute product. And I knew that working in a big company, I mean, you see it every day. There's just like, it's big gears. You're like on this freight ship that like, if you want to make a U-turn, it's going to take quite a bit of time. Where like, if you're by your, when I was by myself, it was like, I was on a jet ski and I can do a 180, like 100 times before the big freight ship could make one turn. Right. So like, you're missing the agility in the big company. The only thing you gained was like all the old school practices of just like leverage over manufacturing, leverage over distribution, you know, distributors and retailers and things, but like you couldn't capitalize on modern ways of doing business. And so I also had a strong itch for just getting back to doing things really different and fresh. And like, I saw an opportunity for a brand that just had a different voice, blah, blah, blah. And I just, you know, I already learned everything I could learn there. I got paid as much as I can get paid. So for me, if you're not progressing financially, or through education, educating and mentally progressing, then it's like time to move on. And so I started Jay with the attitude of like a skateboard brand, very just like shoot from the hip, not take ourselves seriously, expect the unexpected in our marketing, super untraditional attitude. And then I wanted to leverage digital marketing and social media to rally all my fans and my customers to be involved in the brand. So like, we market our customers instead of pro athletes, for instance. And we ask our customers, what do you think of this graphic? And if they like it, then maybe I'll decide to build it. I also want to make things limited edition runs so that when you owned a ski, it wasn't like one of 100,000 that are out there looking like everyone else's. I only make like 400 at a time. I hand sign a number each ski. So you've got this like limited edition. It feels special. It is special to own one. It's not like everyone else. There's more excitement when you can release a product that's limited like that. And I sell exclusively online. I hated going to trade shows. I hated having to spend the winter in a car talking to dealers and stores. I honestly never got to go skiing much. It was kind of bullshit. Like, if you want to go skiing, do not work in the ski industry. And today I did go skiing a lot last year. You know, even during COVID, I was out there like 3 days a week at least. And that was something I could never do before because I was wasting my time standing in convention centers trying to pitch people on why to buy my skis. Now I talk to tens of thousands of customers online, you know, in my customer service and through social media. You know, we have live chat, email, text, you know, 9 a.m. to 10 p.m., 7 days a week. Like, I love being able to communicate directly with my customers. That's not something I was able to do running things through traditional distribution and retailers. Like, you talk to the distributor or retailer, they talk to your customers. So there's a lot of opportunities. It's basically typical e-commerce, modern digital, you know, business strategy that I'm now living in and loving that and having more time to go skiing. The other thing too, John, is just if you want to wrap this whole thing up as to why, you can have a brand that sells 5,000 skis a year and be profitable doing it this way. Before, I would have had to sell 30,000 plus pair. That's what I learned, is that K2, you can never get profitable selling to a retailer until you get up to that huge volume. And as a startup, you will never hit that volume. You can't. If you do, you're spending so much money to do it, you're still not making money. And there's plenty of those smaller brands out there right now.
And that's not unique to the ski industry, right? Like, that is the same if you're going through the traditional retail distribution chain, whether it's bikes or surfboards or whatever, right? Like, now we have the good fortune of technology and e-commerce and social media where you could do something today that you probably couldn't have done at all back in the line days. Do you feel like you had a leg up on everyone else because you had a well-known name, previous success, you know, as an athlete and with the line brand name? Or is this something that if you just execute in the right way, that anyone with a good product could actually disrupt and deliver direct to consumer?
Okay, so it's true, anyone with a good product and a lot of knowledge or utilizing people that understand how to leverage e-commerce and digital marketing, yes, you could scale things up. People do it. You know, they'll create a bar of soap and sell it. Next thing you know, they're 10 million in sales and they're selling it for, you know, selling the business for 10 times that or something. It can happen. You can do that. I'll tell you that for me, I was shocked at how hard it actually is to sell product. I mean, it's hard, you know, like, especially I'm selling something that only could be used when there's snow on the ground. So first off, it's like only a fraction of the country can use it. And only some people within that fraction of the country use it. And only some of the months of the year. So I'm in a niche of a niche. I mean, if you sell a widget that every single human on earth could use, you're going to have a lot easier time, although you might have more competition too. It's all doable, but even with all my history and followers, it was hard to sell a few hundred skis that first year. You know, I sold like 400 pair that first year. And I think the next year I sold like 700. And so, like, I wasn't profitable until I got up to about 2,000 pair. So I did get an investor to get me through those first years. And I actually since paid him back. And, you know, now we're at like 5,000, 6,000 pair and we're doing great. But like back in the 90s, or if you're selling to a retail store even today, 5,000 pair isn't going to make you a profitable business. That's just an art project, you know? Like, financially, you'll be bankrupt until you get up to a huge volume. That is really, really, really difficult when the only way to do it is to ask a retailer to do it for you, basically.
And so for anyone who hasn't seen Jay and your skis, tell us a little bit, like, I kind of think of you and maybe your whole team collectively as artists, because the design of the skis and the graphics are so cool and they're limited editions. So I was on the website checking them out and it tells you like, one, you know, there's only 22 left of this model. And you kind of get into the collectible aspect of it a little bit too. Are you seeing that with your customer base that they just want to collect the skis because they're so special?
Yeah. I mean, they certainly own a few pair. A lot of people do own quite a few pair, which is pretty amazing. Yeah, I don't know, man. Skiers just own skis. Like, it's car lovers own cars, and those things are $60,000 plus. So I think that you know, $600 pair of skis every year. Like a diehard skier wants to buy a new pair, regardless if they were mine or not, or how they looked. But yes, like the graphics, we collaborate with a lot of artists from around the world and brands, you know, from like Bob Ross, like incredible, influential artists that, I mean, we sold out 450 pair in like a few weeks this year. And then we do stuff with like athletes, collaborate with them. Some skis are just jokes, or like we do, you know, Pit Viper is a brand, eyewear brand we collaborated with, or Ski the East, or it's fun because you can just look at things differently than you would traditionally, where you say, okay, I'm going to make, you know, this ski in one graphic and I'm going to sell 10,000 of the same thing. Instead, I'm saying I'm going to make 300 of these, and then I'm going to make 300 of those and 300 of those. And it gives you a lot of fun and flexibility. It's fun for our customers too, for sure.
Yeah. And I think you're totally right. Like I appreciate you saying that, because my wife gets on me every season when I buy another
set. Hey, we actually have a saved answer for how to respond to people that say, I'd love to buy another pair, but my wife's going to kill me.
She's like, why do you need it? I know. Why do you need another pair? I'm like, oh, because this is for this condition. And this is exactly. Like, so yeah, now I can say, well, it's a collectible. So of course you got to have these.
So, yeah. You just remind her how many shoes she's planning on buying this year.
I know, right? There's always a way to get
around. How many shoes do you already have?
And you're right. Like, and it's not collecting cars; it's collecting skis, right? It's pretty.
You're
practical.
Using them, man. You're using them. Yeah, pass them on to your friend when you're done using them. Hang them on the wall, like for artwork. Some people do that.
I know, and I always say that too. I say, oh, I'm going to throw them on Front Porch Forum and sell them. She's like, you never do that. I go, well, you know, I might want to pull them out one of those days. I wish I still have my old K2 missiles.
You had them if you don't save them. You should see my basement, man. My wife would love to get a pallet and a forklift out of there.
Exactly. Right. So I have to ask you now, when you're looking at the future of the industry, and you've seen it from every possible angle at this point, do you see it going in a direction where it becomes more independent and more companies doing what you do? Or do you see the big brands trying to go direct to consumer and compete in the same game that you're at?
Yeah, I mean, for the big companies to not do that is just completely foolish. Like every single business on earth right now is selling online. I mean, it's ridiculous not to. And the ski companies that aren't are just putting themselves further behind, you know, the starting line. So that will happen. And in terms of more brands also starting up, that's also happening because they see that it's possible. You know, they see not only what I'm doing, but there's dozens and dozens of other small ski brands that have realized, oh, okay, this is how you do it. You sell direct, you do this kind of a marketing and blah, 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 customer service. We do this and boom, like they're up and running and they're eventually selling enough. So it opens the door for both. And like, honestly, like the number of skis I'm scraping away from the big brands, they don't even notice, you know, that's the beauty is you don't need to sell a lot, although it's not easy to sell a few thousand pair. It's certainly not easy, but it can be done at least now, where it just wasn't possible previously when I first started Line.
Yeah. Yeah. Like at least there's a path to it.
There is. Yeah.
Today. And so I have to ask, because I'm sure all our listeners here in Vermont would love to know, where are you skiing nowadays?
Stowe and Bolton mostly. Because like, you know, you got to do the night skiing at Bolton and it's only a half hour from here. And then Stowe, you know, family on the weekend sessions and sometimes early mornings.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you just keep coming back to Bolton for the night skiing too. My kids, that's, you know, night skiing and pizza at Bolton.
Oh, it's the best pizza. Bolton has the best pizza. I mean, shit, Burlington, it's ridiculous how good the pizza is everywhere, right? But like Bolton, if you're at the mountain and have like brick oven pizza, it's unbelievable. They're like homemade sauce, all garlicky. Yeah, their pizza is legendary. You know, you come for the pizza, stay for the skiing.
Yeah, exactly, right? That's great.
But no, the skiing's awesome at Bolton. The pow in the woods especially 25 minutes later, you're skiing from when you leave your door.
Yeah.
And I've had a blast, especially with my kid, you know, growing up, just getting in those woods and stuff. And it's chill out there.
Yeah, they're like the best woods for kids to learn tree skiing. It's like perfect for them.
Lots of whoops, man. It's so fun.
Yeah, yeah. And so for all of our listeners, if they want to learn more about you and about Jay and where they can collect some more skis for their collection, despite what their family might say about that.
Yeah.
Where should they go?
jskis.com, J-S-K-I-S.com, just jskis.
And also, you're a pretty good follow on Instagram and Twitter, I think, as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, I personally, yeah, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and my company, Jay, you'll see Jay on there too, jskis on there.
Cool, cool. So for all our listeners, check out jskis.com, check out social media. You can follow, see what the community's up to. I think it's pretty cool just to see all the things you guys are up to. And you kind of see behind the scenes of how you're operating and making skis and all that good stuff. So very cool. And man, thank you so much for making the time to be here. It's an awesome story, and it's a great Vermont story too.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and great conversation. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And to all of our listeners, thank you for being here each week. As you know, we have a new episode that comes out every week. So wherever you're listening, be sure to subscribe. Leave us comments. We'd love to hear from you guys. And until our next episode, happy learning. Hey, everyone. John Tota here. I want to thank you for tuning into the show each week. We love our Learning Life community and are so grateful for your support. We'd appreciate it if you would take a minute to rate us and write a review for Learning Life wherever you're listening right now. Your ratings and comments help new people find the show so we can keep growing our community and bringing great interviews on the topics you care most about.